Hello, and welcome to New Books in Public Policy. My name is Tevi Troy. Each week, we look at a different book in the public policy sphere and talk about its relevance to the current public policy debates we have in this country. This week, we're talking to Eric Weiner, the author of Man Seeks God, My Flirtations with the Divine. Eric calls himself a Confucianist, says he's not really linked to any one religion, and he goes around the world in quest of different religious faiths to find out what attracts people to religion and what makes them believers. It's a very funny book. I hope you read it and enjoy it, but I also hope you listen to and enjoy the upcoming interview. Hello, Eric Weiner, and welcome to New Books in Public Policy.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here.
We're glad to have you on today, and we'd love to talk about your book, Man Seeks God. But first, I'd like to ask you what we traditionally start off with, which is, who are you and how did you come to write this book?
Ooh, those are not easy questions to answer. I am a recovering journalist and an author and a gastronomical Jew. At least that's the way I was brought up. We were all about the bagels and lox and gefilte fish and much less about the Judaism and the spirituality and the rituals, that part of Judaism. So that's how I grew up. And then a few years ago, I found myself in the emergency room of a hospital just outside of Washington, D.C. I was in pain and I was scared. There was something wrong with me. I didn't know exactly what, but I was assuming the worst. The doctors performed some tests. They did some CT scans and x-rays and declared that there was something, quote-unquote, funky on my CT scan. Never a good sign. And so now I'm really worried. And a nurse walks in to draw blood or something, and she must have picked up on my fear because it was pretty obvious. And she leans over and she whispers in my ear the following words: "Have you found your God yet?" And that really kind of sent me over the edge psychologically, because now I'm convinced that there is something terribly wrong with me and that I will soon be meeting my maker, however she had it in mind. And long story short, there was nothing that terribly wrong with me. I was not dying, at least not as quickly as I had feared, just in the way that we're all dying. And, you know, went back to my normal secular gastronomical Jewish life for a while. But that question kept coming back to me. It haunted me, really. Have you found your God yet? And those were her exact words, Tevi. They weren't, have you found God or a God or the God? It was, have you found your God? As if there was just one out there waiting for me. So that sort of propelled me on this literally worldwide search, quest, to answer her question as honestly as I could.
How many different countries did you visit during the course of this quest?
I went to 5 or 6 different countries plus Las Vegas, which may count as its own independent city-state in some ways. I was in Israel and China and Turkey and Nepal and a few places in the U.S. as well.
You said you call yourself a gastronomical Jew, which is an interesting and amusing term. But you also have another word that you use to describe yourself, a Confucianist. You want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, this is an invented word, because when I sat down to sort of embark on this choice, really, and that's what it was, a choice of a religion to follow, I was confronted with the question of, well, what am I other than being sort of culturally Jewish, really? What are my religious beliefs? And none of the labels seem to fit. You know, atheist, well, you know, I have serious doubts about the existence of God, but atheists are pretty certain, in fact, they are certain that God does not exist. And I'm not that certain about anything. I'm not certain about what I should have for breakfast every morning. How can I be so certain that God does not exist? So I scratched atheist and moved on to agnostic, which at first seemed to fit better. An agnostic literally means one without knowledge, and that certainly described me when it comes to matters of faith. But the thing is, agnostics don't know whether God exists, and they don't particularly care, it seems. There's something passive about agnosticism. They're sort of in waiting, they're in receiving mode, you know, just waiting for that evidence of God's existence or the divine or whatever to come to them. And I wanted to be more active than that. I wanted to do things actively. And to be perfectly honest here, I was sort of more hopeful, I think, than the average agnostic. I deeply hope that not only that God exists, but that a sort of divine realm exists. Because I've always suspected, despite my deeply cerebral and rationalistic tendencies, I've always suspected that there is more to this world than meets the eye. So I came up with this term, half joking, half serious, of a confusionist, someone who is deeply and profoundly confused about matters of faith, but who also believes, or I would say hopes, that there is more out there. And I have since learned, by the way, that others in this sort of, you know, grappling for terms that fit have come up with things such as a possibilian. That's another term. Or there's a movement I just learned this afternoon that's gaining steam in the Netherlands called somethingism, the belief that there is something out there.
What is the something?
Yeah, that is the question. And I think that's the question that all of us face. But, you know, it kind of comes down to the term mystery, right? You know, the way we use that word mystery now is that we think mystery is a problem to be solved. But in the more mythological religious sense of the word, the mystery, the great mystery, is something to revel in, something to be awed by, and not necessarily something that needs to be solved. And so when you say, you know, what is that something? I don't know. But I think we have to learn to live with that I don't know and to live with that doubt, because if there's anything I've learned in this journey, it's that doubt and faith are not incompatible as we normally think. I met many people, and I've come to believe myself that one can be a deeply spiritual, a deeply religious person and still be filled with all kinds of doubt, and that's okay.
Yeah. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about your upbringing. I mean, you have a humorous way of describing it where you say Hebrew school is less relevant than breakfast to you. A lot of your jokes have to do with food, I noticed.
I seem to be obsessed with it. In fact, I'm getting hungry just in this discussion, you know, because my appetite's kicking in. Anyway, go ahead.
So why did it not appeal to you? Why was it less relevant to you than breakfast? Did your parents try and impose on you, or did they not care? How did that aspect of it work for you?
I have to be honest here, I was bored. It didn't seem relevant to my life, learning a foreign language, Hebrew, that I wasn't hearing every day, that couldn't help me make new friends or do anything in my everyday life, or learning about these people from thousands of years ago who weren't even smart enough to come up with indoor plumbing, you know, let alone the iPhone. So my thinking, and again, as an 8-year-old, basically, was, well, what can they possibly have to teach me? And also, I think I was exposed to this kind of rule-based Judaism and this very cerebral Judaism that I think a lot of people of my generation were exposed to, that really focuses on these set of rules, you know, the mitzvot that one is to follow. It doesn't really explain why. It just seemed kind of both oppressive and somewhat trivial at the same time. And I realize fully, and I can hear people listening to this saying, well, that's not really Judaism. That's not what Judaism is really about. And that may be true, but it is the Judaism that I was exposed to, or at least that I extracted from those Hebrew school lessons.
So you went on this quest to find religion elsewhere. And one of the stories you tell is you go to India and you see this religious ritual of people dunking themselves in the Ganges, which you say is healthy if the dysentery could be avoided. So it seems like humor is a frequent defense mechanism against, accepting some of the rituals or too much belief in the rituals.
Yeah, I know. Defense mechanism to some extent, in that, you know, I fully acknowledge that one can use humor to shield oneself from having a genuine insight or spiritual moment. But at the same time, humor can be used to convey honesty. And that was honestly how I saw that ritual. you know, people are dunking themselves in the Ganges River, which is hugely polluted, and doing it for their health, their mental and spiritual health. So to me, it seemed odd. And look, you know, I met a Sufi early on in my travels, and he said to me something that I did not understand at the time. He said, "You can't be any wiser than you are." And I think that's true. I realize that now, that, you know, if this looks odd to me, I don't do anyone, including myself, any great service by pretending that, oh, I get it. Oh, I really understand what this ritual is about. I didn't at the time. And I think it's okay to say so in a humorous way. Well, why not? Where is it written that God and humor don't mix? In fact, I think they mix quite well.
I mean, look at all the Jewish comedians, right?
Yeah. Oh, I beg your pardon?
Look at all the Jewish comedians that have been around.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
Definitely used
Jackie them. Mason, and we could go on and
Woody
on.
Allen, and Mel Brooks,
and, et cetera. And not just, you know, making fun of religion necessarily, but having fun with religion. You know, G.K. Chesterton, the British writer, said the test of a good religion is whether one can make fun of it. And there's something to that, because the people I met who were really deeply religious, whether they were Franciscan friars or Kabbalists in Israel, they took their religion seriously. They didn't take themselves too seriously, and they were willing to have some fun with it, that sense of play, which is really at its best a kind of prayer when we're really in deep play. So yeah, it really depends on the kind of humor. Is it mean-spirited, or is it meant to lighten things up and maybe to illuminate the questions at hand?
I certainly found it lighthearted and amusing, and it's one of the selling points of the book. But there is one thing that you're pretty serious about. If there's one serious and recurring thing, it's William James, the Harvard philosopher of the late 19th, early 20th century. Can you talk a little bit about him and why he's important to the book?
Yeah, I'm a huge fan of William James. Now, here is a man who lived in the shadow of his more famous novelist brother, Henry James. Here is a man who was, you know, very cerebral, very rational, a philosopher, went to Harvard, actually went to medical school at Harvard as well, but became profoundly interested at some point in his life in religious experience. And of course, his most famous book, his classic, is The Varieties of Religious Experience. And I thought, well, that's just a very interesting title. Not the varieties of religion or religious rituals or religious theology, but religious experience. So that's what he was interested in. And if you read this book, you'll see that he's interested in these mystical experiences and what people go through, what they get out of it. But the thing about James is that he, you know, as I write in my book, he very much reminded me of a traveler, someone with deep wanderlust, but who couldn't travel for whatever reason and had to rely on these secondhand accounts through books. And by that, I mean, I suspect, and I think it's pretty clear, he envied these people who were able to have these mystical experiences, and he admired them, really. You know, he had a dog in the hunt, and yet, for whatever reason, he couldn't pray. He said he felt silly, and he also suffered from depression throughout his life, as I have, and so I could relate to him in that way. So, yeah, he was one of my guides, if you will, during this journey.
You also, you know, in some of your travels abroad, you had some amusing experiences where you're looking for the great sage in Tibet named Wayne, and you ask what part of Tibet he's from, and you're told Staten Island.
Yeah, I was looking for a lama. I was looking for a Tibetan lama in Kathmandu, thinking, you know, I needed to go to the source and I needed to find a real, genuine teacher. I was very hung up on that. And I couldn't find any. Everyone kept saying, you know, they were all in California or Colorado, suggesting I had flown in the wrong direction. And finally, someone, as you say, suggested Wayne, who turns out was from Staten Island, but has been living in Kathmandu for 30 years, is practically a local in that sense, and is also a practicing and very accomplished Buddhist and meditator. So I did agree to study with Wayne.
Was Wayne Jewish by birth?
He was.
Because there's that whole trend of the Jubus, the Jews who embraced Buddhism.
The Jubus, also the Jufis. Have you heard about the Jufis?
Yeah,
who are Sufi Jews? You know, and Hindus is another one I just picked up the other day. I have to say, in my journeys, because I always would sort of latch on to these converts and disaffected souls, and I ran into two groups, Jews and Catholics. Those were the largest groups of seekers that I encountered out there.
You also have that line in there that Buddhism is Hinduism stripped for export. So I guess Jubuism is Hinduism stripped for export.
Yeah, I like that. I mean, I guess that's actually, I have to give credit to the great Alan Watts for that one. He was right. I mean, Buddhism is much more pared down. I do not write about Hinduism directly in this book. It's not one of the chapters, and I wrestled with that. I was frankly overwhelmed by it. You know, 330 million deities at last count, complex the mythology. Well, Buddhism, there's very little mythology, if any, and there's actually, in a way, very little theology, at least not in the Judeo-Christian sense. Buddhism is more like a doctor's prescription. You know, the Buddha diagnosed the human condition, all was suffering. He found a cause for this condition, and that is essentially desire and our fixation on desire. And he wrote out a little RX prescription for it, which is essentially the Noble Eightfold Path, which involves meditation and a variety of other spiritual practices. And it's much more clean cut and direct that way. And I think that's one reason why even atheists have grudging and sometimes more than grudging respect for Buddhism.
I like how you bring religions alive through various characters who embrace the religions or symbols of the religion. You talk about the guy, and I'm going to butcher his pronunciation, and I ask for your correction, is the Rinpoche? Is that how you pronounce it?
Oh, that's pretty darn good. The Rinpoche, yes.
And how he...
That's a title, actually, the Rinpoche.
And how he meets Cher, and she expects some spiritual wisdom from him, and he tells her that she looks like a bag of bones, which I can't imagine went over very well.
No, it did not go well. And so this guy intimidated me. I mean, here's a man who stared down both, you know, the evil goddess Maya, the goddess of delusion, and also Cher. He has a bit of a following there in Kathmandu, particularly among Westerners.
Yeah, but he didn't like your experiment, right? He disapproved of shopping for God.
Yeah, that was my sort of working title for the book at the time, Shopping for God, and that's the way I sort of explained it. And I sit down with him, and you know, I only have a couple of minutes. I'm very nervous, and my friend James introduces me and says, "This is Eric. He's on this expedition. He's shopping for God." And I can immediately tell by the sour look on the Rinpoche's face that he didn't approve. And so I thought the problem was this shopping metaphor was too gimmicky for him. So I said, "No, it's not really shopping. It's seeking. I'm seeking God." And he still said, "No, it's a bit limited," he said. I said, well, no, I mean, I'm not being limited. I'm going to Turkey and Israel and China. I'm going everywhere." And then it dawned on me, the limited part for him was not the shopping part, it was the God part. He found God a bit limited because, of course, Buddhists don't believe in a God, and at least not in the way we think of it as a, you know, omniscient, omnipresent being or divine being. So, I thought that was very telling. Leave it to a Tibetan Lama to suggest that a book that seeks God is a bit limited.
Yeah. Well, I actually was at your book party a few weeks ago, and I met a fellow named Matteo, who seemed like a very nice guy, well-read, thoughtful guy. And you in the book describe him as, I guess, the James Bond of Buddhism or something like that. And
Bond of Tibetan Buddhism.
Right.
Yeah, he's always, because he's very much involved in the human rights aspect of the Tibetans as well, and he's always smuggling out film in the soles of his shoes and doing all these slightly dangerous things, but he's an impressive person, Matteo.
Yeah, he didn't strike me as somebody who would be carrying a Walther PPK like Bond does. But why did he?
Well, because he is a Buddhist at heart too.
That's
so,
true. You know. And he has this experiment, the bicycle experiment. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, we're sitting in a little cafe in Kathmandu, And he says to me, and this is because I'm wrestling with these Buddhist concepts of non-existence, that nothing really exists, at least not the way we think of it. And this was actually causing some anxiety on my part. Nothing exists, and maybe even I don't exist. And I was kind of freaking out. So I asked Mateo about it. And he said, well, you see that bicycle over there? It's bicycle parked sort of just on the edge of the cafe. I said, yes. He said, well, go over and touch it. And I went over and I touched the bicycle seat, I suppose. And he said, no, you touched the seat. You didn't touch the bicycle. So I went over and I touched the wheel. He's like, no, you touched the wheel. That's not the bicycle. Please touch the bicycle. I touched the frame of the bike. He said, no, you touched the metal tube. Please touch the bicycle. And of course, the point he was trying to make, and which he made quite effectively, is that the bicycle does not really exist except as an abstract concept in our mind. You know, it's like that old parable about the five blind men and the elephant, and they're all holding a different part of the elephant, touching it, and one touches the trunk and says, oh, it's a cylinder, it's this thing. Another touches the leg of an elephant and says, it's a tree trunk. And of course, they were all right, but they were all wrong. Nobody was seeing the big picture.
It also reminds me a little bit of the college teacher I had who described to me the Socratic method as this guy Socrates, who's asking all these questions about first premises and first premises and first premises until everybody else says, go away, Socrates, we don't want to talk to you anymore.
You get frustrated. And I had that experience with Wayne, too, when he would say these apparently contradictory things. Like, I would ask him, Wayne, well, what's the first step in meditation? And he would just look at me and say, first steps are often last steps. And at one point, he suggested I needed to be thrown back against my own experience, which struck me not only as a bit obtuse, but possibly violent as well. And this is common to so many religions, especially the Eastern ones, Buddhism and particularly Taoism. These apparently contradictory statements that appear mutually exclusive, but the Buddhists and the Taoists don't see it that way. It can be up and down and hot and cold at the same time.
Yeah, is that some kind of, is it really philosophical, or is it some kind of verbal trickery that they learned somewhere in monk school or whatever about how to manipulate your words to make these apparent contradictions come to life?
Well, I'm not sure what you mean by that. Are you suggesting that it's verbal trickery and that it doesn't represent a reality? If that's the case, I'll disagree. I think maybe we are the ones in the West who are engaged in verbal trickery by believing, as we do, that things are either or and cannot possibly be both. I think they only engage in verbal trickery in that sort of Zen koan sort of way to try to trick us into seeing things more clearly. It's the, whack upside the head. So no, I absolutely do not think it's verbal trickery. I think it's meant to try to illuminate some truth and to get us to think about things in a less binary way that we've come to view things in the West.
But do you think they learn from whoever taught them beforehand that when you're given A, you can say B to make it seem like A is not really B, or to play these kind of tricks like you said, where you can start from first premises?
It seems to me that should
be an aspect of the teaching.
Well, I think the aspect of the teaching is to get to talk about things in different ways. And I suppose just like any religion, there are Buddhist monks who go through the motions and parrot back these little aphorisms or ways of looking at things. But I've met Buddhists who I think really get it, really get the fact that, well, we're in Taoism, the concept of yin yang, the complementary polar opposites that are not only opposites, but interdependent on one another. So no, I think that like any religion, some people like in a synagogue or church are just reading the lines from the Bible or the Torah, and others really get it. And it was those people who really get it that I was drawn to throughout this book.
You made a comment on page 154, at least in the version I have. I don't know if the page has changed from the uncorrected proof to the final, but about how how you're pro-choice and you don't know anyone who is pro-life, or you've never met anyone who's pro-life. And that kind of jumped out at me. I mean, your background, I know you're a New York Times reporter and an NPR reporter. Is that sort of typical of people in that milieu?
Yes, absolutely. East Coast, the Acela Corridor. I have never met anyone in my life who has expressed to me that they are pro-life. Maybe they were and they didn't tell me. But, you know, this is, I think, one of the problems with just hanging out with your own kind, so to speak, is you're not exposed to other points of view. So, yeah, that statement was an accurate one.
It's like that famous line, I believe it was Pauline Kael in 1972 after Nixon's landslide victory, who said, "I don't know a single person who voted for him. How could he have won?"
Exactly. It's exactly like that. But I really approach this with an open mind. And I think, not to pat myself on the back, but I think I'm pretty good at approaching points of view very different from mine and being open to the possibility that they might be right or they might be onto something. And see, that's the thing. Those pilgrims on the Ganges dunking in the water, that brackish, dirty water, on the one hand, seems crazy. You might get God knows what kind of disease doing that. On the other hand, they're clearly benefiting it from it spiritually, just by the way their face is aglow. So both may be true. It's maybe unhealthy, and they're taking a risk with their physical health, but it's doing an awful lot for them spiritually.
You know, of all the religions you mentioned in the book, I think the one that may be hardest for your average reader to relate to is the Raelians. And tell me if I'm getting that pronunciation right. But and they're sort of, I mean, the word alien seems to be apparent when you say it out loud. And they're kind of extraterrestrial approach to religion.
They're out there, aren't they?
Yeah. And at one point you even, I guess, are polite and say the Raelians deluded or not, leaving it up to the reader to decide. But can you talk a little bit about their approach and how you...
Yeah, well, in short, their creation myth, every religion has a creation myth, and theirs is that we humans were created not by God, but by an alien race called the Elohim, and that they were created essentially in a laboratory 25,000 years ago, and we were created for one purpose, essentially, to have as much pleasure as possible. And I say deluded or not because when it comes to, let's say, the creation myths of any religion, be it the virgin birth or anything else, or the burning bush or whatever, I think we get overly hung up on whether these myths are true or not. Myths are not supposed to be true, not in a scientific sense. They're supposed to be true in that they have something to teach us. And I also think that, okay, I'll be perfectly upfront here. I find it highly unlikely that the Raelians are correct and that's how we came to be on this planet. But does that mean they absolutely have nothing to say then, nothing of value for their followers? No, I don't think it says that at all.
That was really going out on a limb that they may not be accurate, but I appreciate that. That's bold. We talked a little bit earlier about your Jewish experience and how that's what you grew up with. But you also examined Judaism as a religion by going to Safat and going to Israel and talking about Kabbalah. And there's one person you talk to and you ask to sum up Judaism in one word and you say rules.
Right.
Is that kind of what turned you off to it when you were in
Jewish
school?
Yes, it is. That this idea that you follow the rules, you don't question the rules, and that the rules might be very ancient and may have made sense 5,000 years ago, but don't seem relevant to me today. And so my friend just articulated what I had always felt. And I wanted to get away from that because I sensed that I hoped that there was another kind of Judaism out there, a Judaism of the heart. And that's what I pursued in Sfat in Israel.
Yeah, there was one passage in the book that I just read out loud to my wife after reading it about how this one woman who is not at all religious, but she was born Jewish, she's a secular woman, I guess she was from Venezuela, and she stops in Brooklyn to see the Rebbe, or Rebbe Schneerson, of the Lubavitch group, and she had no intention of meeting with him. She was going with him on a lark to, I guess, for her cousin, and his eyes just grabbed her, and she went and entered religious school. And then you say 8 years later, she now has kids, a wig, and sits behind a partition.
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit about her and what you found when you're talking to her?
Well, here's this dramatic transformation of what I suppose is known in Hebrew as the Baal Tshuva, right? Someone who's returned to their faith. And it's considered a very important thing. And a Baal Tshuva is, in my understanding, considered more noble, if you will, than someone who just inherited their faith and continued it and stuck with it. It's an amazing story, and it's one I've heard in different religions too, that one charismatic figure, Rabbi Schneerson in this case, is able with their eyes or voice or their mere presence to convince someone that this is where they should be, that they have found their home. And this woman's life changed dramatically, really, because of that one encounter. And look, I'll be honest, I wrestled with the chapter on Judaism more than any other chapter, because here I was confronting my own sense of guilt, of regret, whatever you want to call it. It's a lot easier to write about the Buddhists or even the Raelians, because they're the quote-unquote other. It's much harder to write about your own backyard.
Yeah, the story sounded almost like a Jedi mind trick, right? He said she's going to religious school, and she was actually going, I guess, to art school and
architecture school.
And then he, just by the power of suggestion, convinces her to change her plans and go to religion school.
What do you think of that?
I never met the Rebbe. He died about 15 years ago, but I heard that he had this very powerful effect on people, and that just looking into his eyes really could change lives.
Yeah, and I've met a Jewish man who met a spiritual leader who was part of the Sikh tradition in India, and had a similar effect. And instead of becoming an Orthodox Jew, he became a Sikh and wears a turban to this day. And so sometimes sometimes it's a book, you know, like St. Augustine famously was told by a child, pick it up and read it. It being the Bible, and that transformed his life from one of sin to redemption. And sometimes it can be just attending a ritual of some kind. And sometimes it can be this charismatic spiritual leader that seems to be more important than what spiritual tradition they happen to belong to. And that will propel someone in an entirely different direction with their religious life.
Well, that seems like an appropriate place to close things up. If you wanted one message to be conveyed from the book by somebody who picked it up, let's say a little child told St. Augustine and descended, pick it up and read it, what would be the message that would come out of your book? And how would you think that would shape how we Americans approach religion?
Boy, that's a tough question.
I specialize in those at New Books and Public Policy. So.
Yeah, okay. We're the easy questions. I'm going to bring this full circle back to William James, because he once said something that has really stuck with me. He said, truth is what works. And when I first heard that, I thought, well, what the heck does that mean? I mean, if I say 2 + 2 = 5, that works for me. That doesn't seem right. But I don't think that's what James meant. I think what he meant is, if a religion or spiritual practice works for you, if it makes you a better person, happier, calmer, more compassionate, then it is true, in one sense of the word, at least. And I think, you know, we get awfully hung up in this country about belief. What do you believe? That's what we ask each other. That's what we ask our politicians, certainly. What are your religious beliefs? We get very hung up on ritual and liturgy and conflict. But ultimately, the test of any religion is its results. And if it makes its followers better people in a very everyday sense and makes them happier, then it is true and it is good. And I think that ultimately, that's how I approach religion, as a kind of applied philosophy, you know, wisdom, you know, that we can use, not when it comes to the next life, if you believe in that, but in this life, to get through the day a little bit happier and a little bit wiser than you thought possible.
It reminds me of the old Dennis Prager parable about, if you had five youths walking towards you on a dark street, would you be comforted if you'd known they'd just come from a Bible study? And I guess, yeah, you probably would. So maybe that leads to people, better people.
A Bible study or a Torah study, or a mosque, I would say, or a Buddhist temple. Yeah, any house of worship. I think, look, you know, if you're looking for a book that points out the hypocrisies in religion or the dangers of religion, then you really shouldn't read my book, because there's plenty else out there that will do that point of view justice.
Dawkins. You could talk to Christopher Hitchens, who just passed away.
Yeah, Hitchens, Dawkins, you can read those books. I purposefully, even as a hard-bitten journalist, set out in this book to look at the best of religion. Where does religion shine? And I was surprised just how much brightness I found out there.
Well, Eric Weiner, you've been very generous with your time. I appreciate you coming on New Books in Public Policy, and good luck with the book.
Thank you so much. This has been a real pleasure.
Thank you for listening to my interview with Eric Weiner, journalist and part-time comedian who went around the world to talk to different religious folks about what brings them to religion, and how religion can have a transformative effect on people's lives. It's a funny book. It's got a serious message, though, about how important religion can be. And I hope you enjoyed the interview. This is Tebby Troy signing off, and as I say every week, keep reading.